Welcome. You're listening to What the Tech. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Valerie Haskins Moore, and I'm reading today from the 2023 July-August issue of Wired Magazine, as well as other sources, as we have time. Today is our first entry will be to conclude our article entitled Building a Platform Like Twitter is Not Difficult, about Christopher Boozy. This is by Brendan Kerner. I am happy to help try to come up with a policy that provides clear guidance, says Courtney Milan. The offer rankled Boozy, who chafed at the implication that he hadn't put enough thought into building his site. So, when another member of Spoutable's budding Romancelandia community asked whether he'd consider talking to Milan, Boozy did not mince words. Milan is more than welcome to start a social media platform and write the terms of service and policies however she likes, he replied. But the policy isn't changing here, nor is it being rewritten. Boozy's curt refusal to engage with Milan, a Spoutable enthusiast who'd even donated money to the startup, irked many of her fans and fellow authors, and some vowed to quit the platform in protest. Milan, meanwhile, hopped over to Twitter to expand on her gripes and voice her dismay at Boozy's cold shoulder. The response to her comments turned contentious, with Spoutable's faithful branding her a chaos agent bent on destroying their new favorite site. Rather than put out a conciliatory statement to defuse the situation, Boozy opted for a belligerent approach. Just before dawn, on February 20th, he spouted a screenshot of Milan's Wikipedia profile. He'd highlighted a sentence that details an upsetting episode from her past. In 2006 and 2007, Milan had clerked for a federal judge who allegedly forced her to watch pornography, an experience she revealed publicly in 2017 as part of the Me Too movement. Boozy wrote just one sentence to accompany the image. It's clear this person has an agenda. That provocation had predictably ugly results. Milan, who had announced she was done with Spoutable, shot back at Boozy on Twitter. What made you think it was okay for one hot second to send me harassment about the fact that I was sexually harassed? Then she said she was blocking Boozy. When some of her followers spouted about their displeasure with Boozy's behavior, they found their accounts suspended. Boozy denies that he took action against any of these accounts because they had expressed opinions he didn't like. But there were also plenty of people who took Boozy's side and lampooned Milan as a Karen. She tried to walk into a black man's social media platform and volunteered to write new TOS, one supporter tweeted. Do you think she did that with Facebook or Twitter? By day's end, Boozy had deleted his barbed spout about Milan and apologized to his followers for having written something inarticulate. Milan told me that she never received a personal apology from Boozy. When I spoke to him the following afternoon, he acknowledged that he needs to be a more conscientious poster now that he's the public face of a social media company, especially one that aims to be a paragon of online decency. Old habits are hard to break, he said. And I'm trying, believe me, I am, because I feel at the end of the day, I don't want to be Elon Musk. I really don't, right? I don't want my opinions on certain things to make someone else feel uncomfortable or to eliminate other folks. It's something I'm working on. Yet, later that day, on Boozy's Twitter account, I saw that he'd pinned a fresh swipe at Milan. Above a famous photograph of a civil rights activist calmly smoking a cigarette next to a riot cop, Boozy had written, "You created an account at Spoutable. You didn't like the adult nudity and sexual content policy, so you asked to speak to the manager. The manager is a black man who told you the policy stays, and your brain couldn't process being told no by a black man. Happy Black History Month." According to Boozy, the Milan affair ended up a net win for Spoutable. The uproar had ironically made more people aware of the platform's Kindness First mission, and the daily signups increased by 129% right after the drama petered out. I also noticed a groundswell of lavish praise for Boozy. Pound Boozy Did It trended on Spoutable, and fans created memes to celebrate his accomplishments. One featured a male model applying some Spoutable-branded deodorant, along with the tagline, try our new anti-Nazi formula and smell sexy again. But, as if to underscore how polarizing Boozy can be, an account called @Vooten proceeded to buck all the adulation by spamming out thousands of GIFs of a kitten on a motorcycle, each accompanied by a slight variations of the hashtag #PoundFuckBoozy. Those Profane hashtags quickly became the only ones trending in the Making Waves section on the site's front page. Once at Vooten had grabbed everyone's attention, they then posted a series of allegations about Boozy's crypto activities from nearly a decade ago. These spouts included evidence purporting to show iconic expert orchestrated a pump-and-dump scheme for an obscure altcoin. When I spoke to Boozy about that incident the next day, he stressed that it would make the platform stronger in the long run. Spoutable would henceforth take additional steps to prevent sabotage, such as creating a blacklist of virtual phone numbers that scammers often use to circumvent verification procedures. And Boozy was pleased that scores of Spoutable users had reported the spammer, resulting in Atvooten's speedy banishment from the site. Yet there was a trace of exhaustion in his efforts to cheerlead for Spoutable, and I eventually asked how his mental health was holding up as he dealt with all the venom being thrust his way. "Look, it's not like I'm a robot and it doesn't affect me in some way. I'm a human being," he said, but he added that the public hate he deals with is balanced out by the supportive messages he receives in private, and those kind notes have given him the confidence to dig his heels in even deeper. "I'm not going to let the trolls get to us," he insisted. Boozy said he hopes to recede into the background once Spoutable, which has some 240,000 registered accounts as of early June, is a bit more established, a plan welcomed by those who understand the potential users may balk at joining a platform whose controversial founder looms too large. Phil Schneider, for one, is in favor of hiring an executive whose name will be attached to all of the company's announcements, including the most mundane. "You need to have someone else taking the flack," he says. "Then it doesn't get to be a situation where you're heating up the, you know, cult of I hate Chris." Boozy is not shy about talking up his long-term ambitions for Spoutable, some of which can sound a touch delusional. His platform is still a gnat compared to mighty Twitter, which has roughly 238 million daily users, and Spoutable has attracted significantly less media attention than buzzier peers like Jack Dorsey's Blue Sky, the focus of much excitement this spring when invitations to test its beta version were a hot commodity. Yet Boozy nonetheless argues that Spoutable is primed to become Twitter's most successful heir, and his boasts often include shade directed at better financed rivals. Back in December, Post News was seeking a valuation of $250 million, he tweeted in March. "It will be interesting to see how Spoutable is valued with higher traffic numbers." Post has yet to share any user statistics. Boozy was referring to web traffic data, which doesn't necessarily correlate with the number of active accounts. At another point, he scoffed at the much-heralded debut of Substack Notes, the newsletter giant's effort to poach business from Twitter. "I don't even think Substack Notes is going to be able to compete with us," he told me. Those are bold pronouncements from a CEO whose startup has so little capital to burn. In one of our final conversations, Boozy admitted to me that Spoutable's cash reserves are dwindling. Though the platform has been asking users for donations of $5 and up, he estimated that he had only enough money to keep going for 2 or 3 more months. But he added that advertisements are on the way and that he expects user registration to skyrocket once the mobile app is finally launched. Boozy believes that Spoutable can get over the hump if a fair portion of those new accounts are opened by a particular sort of users. "Journalists will ultimately decide who's going to be the new king," he said. "We know how important journalists are to those platforms. And then we also know how important the platforms are to the journalists to get their reporting out. So it's kind of a symbiotic relationship. We are going to make a huge effort to get more journalists." They did start to arrive in modest numbers this spring, lured in part by Spoutable's offer to automatically verify anyone who possessed a blue check mark on Twitter. In late March and early April, along with an influx of celebrities like Monica Lewinsky and Seinfeld actor Jason Alexander, several journalists whose name I recognize joined. I spotted respected reporters from major outlets like the New York Times, the Associated Press, and NPR. NPR had recently left Twitter entirely after its account was branded government-funded media. Yet, few of these luminaries have spouted more than a handful of times, and many have been entirely silent. They are, it seems, laying claim to their account names just in case Spoutable becomes a big enough deal to merit their consistent presence. The wariness is still a central problem for all of the aspirants to Twitter's throne. In this prolonged moment of uncertainty over Twitter's future, it seems that everyone is staking out territory on multiple alternative platforms. We're all still roulette balls spinning around the rim of the social media wheel, waiting to see where circumstances compel us to land. But if we expect to alight somewhere that will give us the same warm glow we recall from our finest Twitter experiences, we're almost certain to be disappointed. My months of experimental spouting made clear why that's the case. The platform gave me tons of progressive venting and mash notes to the successes, but little information that had the potential to push me out of my comfort zone. I seldom stumbled across a linked article that taught me something surprising or incisive commentary from a true expert in their field. My own spouts, meanwhile, about topics ranging from ham radio to parenting to Mark Rothko's alcoholism, attracted meaningful interest only when Boozy reposted or echoed what I'd written to his 40,000 followers. Absent that boost, I often felt like I was spouting into the void. Perhaps Spoutable is simply not the place for a cynical nerd like me. I can see that it's a utopia for some, people scarred by the cruelty of Twitter who now thrill to operating on a platform where they can easily get pound traitor Trump or pound happy anniversary Harry and Meghan trending amid an earnest and unchallenged chorus of amens. I understand why there's demand for the type of refuge and that there might be another one that's more suited to my sensibility. But the siloing of social media communities still makes me wistful for the dynamic Twitter of a dozen years ago. Because it had coalesced before everyone understood the perils of participating in a single gargantuan chat room, Twitter was a place where people with opposing worldviews came to operate in close proximity to one another. And rubbing together radically different varieties of the human experience can lead not just to bitter conflict, but also to the sublime. Those revelatory moments when an argument, observation, or acidic joke stretches your perception of lives quite unlike your own. That gorgeous messiness will probably be lost as Twitter, like so many historical entities that were undone by their unwieldiness, balkanizes into numerous collectives of the similarly minded. Maybe each of us will find some measure of satisfaction in the relative harmony of the new platforms now vying for our attention. When the roulette wheel stops spinning, it seems likely that we'll all have landed in very different places, or maybe have realized it's finally time to pry ourselves away from the casino for good. Well, that concludes the article, Building a Platform Like Twitter is Not Difficult, by Brendan Corner. In the July-August 23 issue of Wired Magazine. Our next article comes from the July-August issue of Wired Magazine 2023. This is from their column entitled Dear Cloud Support by Megan O'Gleblin. Dear Cloud Support, I'm the best man in my friend's wedding this summer, and I'm dreading the speech. I have absolutely no idea what to say. Should I get an AI to help me? Or would that make me the worst man? Signed, Lost for Words. Dear Lost, you're certainly not alone in realizing that some onerous creative or emotive task can be completely, relatively, painlessly done with AI. The same thought has undoubtedly occurred to the tongue-tied Tinder user who discovers that he can list a digital Cyrano to pen his opening lines to a prospective date, or to the exhausted mother who recognizes that she has at her fingertips a tireless Chazered that can produce an infinite scroll of bedtime stories for her children, or to the overworked son who realized that he can generate, in seconds, a personalized poem for his father's retirement party. Creatively expressing our feelings to others is time-consuming, uncompensated, and emotionally taxing. That is, at any rate, the message implicit in some of the marketing of large language models. When Microsoft, for example, introduced its AI Copilot products in March, it imagined a mother using the software to generate a speech for her daughter's high school graduation. There are multiple ways you might use an LLM to produce a moving toast, ranging from the least intrusive, asking ChatGPT for writing tips or a quick proofread, or to the more hands-on, generating a draft of the speech, which you can then customize. New sites like ToastWiz have built tools on top of GPT-4 that allow you to plug in your stories and feelings and generate three unique outputs for $30. Meanwhile, wedding planning apps like Joy have incorporated AI that promises to help users with their toughest wedding-related wordage. The feature can produce toasts or even vows in the style of Shakespeare or Rumi and aims to help users bring their emotions onto paper in fun and creative ways. These are not the most commercial products that have promised to offshore the difficult work of human expression, or what is increasingly called emotional labor. Long before the recent AI boom, people turned to human ghostwriters to pen wedding speeches. Toast whisperers, as the New York Times noted in 2015, were an under-the-table service that many clients were too embarrassed to admit paying for. And I imagine that you, like many people, have for years sent greeting cards that leverage the words of a professional writer to articulate what are allegedly your own thoughts and emotions. This practice, of course, was not without controversy and critics. Hallmark's very first slogan, introduced in 1944, was, "When you care enough to send the very best," a linguistic sleight of hand that inverted the most common critique of commercial greeting cards, that relying on the words of professionals was, in fact, evidence that you did not care enough to speak from your heart. Such products have long approached what sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild calls the commodity frontier, the threshold of activities we deem too personal to pay for. It's a perimeter that exists even when the products we enlist are, for the moment, free, and the arrival of new technologies calls for its constant renegotiation. In the case of AI, there have already been some breaches of this still hazy border. When Vanderbilt University enlisted ChatGPT to generate an email offering condolences to the victims of the mass shooting at Michigan State, the school was criticized for using automated tools for a gesture that demanded, as one student put it, genuine human empathy, not a robot. Writing a wedding speech would seem to require similar emotional engagement, but perhaps you have reasoned that intent and selection, it's the thought, are what matters in these situations. You are, after all, the one providing the model with the essential Albert Roth emotive ingredients to produce the finished product. In conversations, the AI-generated text, the prompt is often spoken of as the logos, the spiritual breath of human authenticity that animates the synthetic output, dismissed as so much mechanical wordage, with life and meaning. Just as the computer was for Steve Jobs, a bicycle for the mind, so language generation tools might be regarded as the vehicle that transports the spirit of our emotions from their point of origin to a desired destination. But I'm not sure it's so easy to separate intent from expression or emotions from behavior. Some psychological experiments have demonstrated that it's our words and actions that allow us to experience emotions, not the other way around. Like the famous example of how forcing oneself to smile can induce a feeling of happiness. It's possible that expression, including linguistic expression, is not a mere afterthought in our emotional lives, but the whole point. If that's true, then the decision to outsource your speech writing might contribute to a kind of emotional atrophy, a gradual loss of the ability to truly inhabit your internal states or modulate them. A podcaster recently boasted that a friend of his who struggles with anger management uses AI tone filters when communicating with people who provoke his temper, feeding rageful rants into ChatGPT and asking the model to rewrite them in a, quote, nicer way. If I can offer some more prescriptive parting advice, Lost, I'd urge you to consider that the logic of the commodity frontier can work in reverse. It's not that there are certain realms of human experience that are intrinsically too sacred to automate, which seems to be what you're getting at when you ask whether using AI for your speech would make you the worst man. On the contrary, it may be that human intimacy blooms in precisely those pockets of life that have not yet been widely exploited by commercial or mechanical forces. Perhaps our very notion of meaningful human connection depends on our refusal to relinquish such emotional work. In the end, it's the effort we put into a task that determines its subjective significance. If you decide to hand over the speechwriting work to a machine, then you are essentially confirming that it is meaningless boilerplate. If, on the other hand, you decide to write the toast yourself, you will undoubtedly come to see this work and the end product as important, if only because your actions have reinforced your belief that it is worthy of your time and attention. Maybe the speech won't achieve a Toastmaster-ish polish or a Hallmark card's concision, but your words may lead you to your own emotions, which, for the time being, we aren't so eager to automate. Faithfully, Cloud. That was Dear Cloud Support. Can I have AI write my friend's wedding speech as best man? By Megan O'Gilbin, who is the author most recently of God, Human, Animal, Machine. Our next article is an interview entitled The Witchy Ambition of Seema Sistani. This is by Lauren Good. Schwab's burgers and melted ice cream. Those are the food items logged in my memory from the night I first met Seema Sistani. That was a decade ago, before she became the chief executive of Weight Watchers. Sistani was working at Yahoo, and I had just moved to Silicon Valley. A mutual friend connected us, and Sistani invited me over for dinner. I accepted with, "What can I bring?" This is how I ended up buying charcoal-colored beef patties at her preferred butcher. That night, we talked about Yahoo's content business. We talked about Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In. We talked for so long, the ice cream became soup in our bowls. It was some kind of indoctrination into the valley. It was also evident that Sistani wanted to be someone. Her sharp observations about the tech industry continued long into the night. What wasn't obvious, because why would it be? And whose business was it anyway, was that Sistani was logging her food in the Weight Watchers app. She and her husband had recently had their first baby, Adrian, and she was attempting to lose weight she'd gain during pregnancy. Sistani's career had been a winding one. After jobs at Goldman Sachs Creative Artists Agency and a short-lived tech startup, she became the head of media for Yahoo-owned Tumblr. Then the VP of media for Meerkat, a buzzy live-streaming video startup. She and a Meerkat founder decided to stealthily launch a second live video app called House Party. In 2019, Epic Games acquired that venture for a reported $35 million. Sistani didn't need to work again, but in 2020, she contacted Weight Watchers and expressed interest in advising the company on its digital strategy, planting a seed that would eventually result in the chief executive role. Something about Weight Watchers' emphasis on community was appealing. It was, in fact, this sense of community that had set the company apart in its earliest days. It started in 1962 in Gene Nidetch's living room, and by 1968, it had 1 million members across the world. In 2018, Weight Watchers attempted a rebrand, changing its name to WW and focusing on general well-being instead of just dieting. The company tried to capitalize on the wellness movement that people were gravitating toward as a kind of salve for the society's ills, and we hadn't even lived through a pandemic yet. It did not go well. When Sistani took the helm in March of 22, Weight Watchers was on the path to recording a loss of over $250 million that year. The pandemic had nearly killed its in-person retail business and its digital business, which charges for access to science-backed nutrition plans and a members-only social network, was also in decline. Sistani was brought in to chart a digital path through a post-pandemic world to give the service more social juice, both online and off. Of course, the company's renewed mission is now colliding head-on with the body positivity movement, which encourages acceptance instead of weight change and competing with digital apps like Noom and MyFitnessPal and drugs like Ozempic that promise to make dropping pounds oh so easy. It's weight loss whiplash. What a time to be the new CEO of Weight Watchers, a service that, despite its millions of still satisfied subscribers, has hordes of critics calling its point-based system the epitome of unhealthy diet culture. So in April, I asked to spend some time with Sistani and met her at Shiraz Kitchen and Wine Bar, a Persian restaurant in Manhattan's Chelsea neighborhood. The next day, I made my way to the high-ceilinged Weight Watchers offices on 6th Avenue. I sat with Sistani in her private office and in various meetings, including one where staffers talked about new weight loss medications at length. Tuesday, April 18th at Shiraz, a server delivers a platter of desserts and 3 mugs of tea and says, "This is baklava, this is Persian love cake, that's chocolate mousse, that's saffron ice cream." Lauren Good: "Oh, wow. Sistani, thanks so much. How many points is this?" "Oh, I can do this in my head. Right off the top, I would say each one of these is going to be 5 points. My guess here," she gestures to the baklava, "is the nuts are going to drive this one higher. I bet this," points to the ice cream, "is like 8 points. And then the chocolate mousse is anyone's guess. Well, everything's on the menu. You really have to try the saffron ice cream. It's a Persian delicacy. You're a first-generation American, correct? Yes, born in Texas. I grew up in Alabama, but my parents were immigrants from Iran. They didn't expect to stay here. My dad was getting his master's degree in soil science, and then Iran imploded. When my mom got pregnant with me, the war and the Iran hostage crisis were happening, and my mom said, you know what, we're not going back. I'm taking us on a tangent, but the year I graduated from Duke, my mom got her PhD in food science. She is also a registered dietitian. The year I got the job at Weight Watchers, my mom became chair of her department and of consumer sciences. It ends up coming full circle. I moved to North Carolina because I was taking the job at Epic. I thought, I'm leaving my career behind because my career was Silicon Valley and I was moving out here. But when Weight Watchers came up, it was a moment to say, oh, I can just take all those learnings from my past and I can apply them to a totally different business and industry. The things I'm passionate about, like growth tech and the social internet, I can apply to networks that will actually have massive health outcomes. That was eye-opening for me. And you decided to split time between North Carolina and New York City? We did have 1 week. My first day at Weight Watchers was, because I'm a little witchy, the Persian New Year. March 21st is the vernal equinox. She rolls up her sleeve. This is 14 in Farsi in my mother's handwriting. My father has that tattoo, and my brother does too. 14 is the date of my son Adrian's birthday, my daughter Adrian's birthday, and my brother's birthday, and my parents' anniversary. When we moved to North Carolina, it was June 14th, and I accepted this role on February 14th of 2022. I'm not planning this stuff. Witchy, what do you mean by that? Oh, it just means that I believe in a higher power. I believe in doing good and in karma, the golden rule. I didn't grow up with religion. Technically, I'm Muslim, but my parents never ascribed to organized religion. But growing up in the South in a very Christian community where kids would go to summer camps, I did wish for a religion. Sometimes I felt sad that I'm not taking my kids to those places because there's really great community there. Where I've netted out in my life is it's a mountain, and different people have different paths up the mountain. I describe it as witchy because agnostic suggests you don't care. Your community is largely women, right? And you as CEO have a sphere of influence. What's your position on women's health where you live? Our employees are 75% women, so we are very clear when Roe versus Wade was overturned that we would help our employees have access to reproductive rights no matter where they are. Last year, we did a lot of work on food insecurity. On the onus is on us again because we're having this conversation about these GLP diabetes medications. Most people who are taking them are either paying cash or they're working for a company like ours and have insurance coverage, which means that the communities that need it most do not have access. So that's a place we can try to move policy that black and brown communities that need it more than most of the rest of the population have access. April 19th, Weight Watchers headquarters. In your marketing meeting just now, your team really leaned on the story of Jean Nittich for the 20th anniversary campaign. Tell me about Jean. That was one of the craziest things I discovered when I joined. Weight Watchers is a company founded by this woman, Jean Nittich, and especially when the world went through its girl boss moment. Nobody talks about her. When she first started the company, she couldn't even sign the lease. Her husband had to sign it for her. And then she got divorced and started dating Fred Astaire. Her story is wild. You know, the whole move to calling the company WW in 2018 was a glossy way of trying to be like, we're wellness, but I decided, no, let's have the hard conversation. And what we're trying to say is that living overweight and with obesity is a health detractor. If we want to be the best at helping people manage their weight, the conversation is about health and weight. That's what you come to us for, not for meditation or sleep advice. WW is fine, but we're going to re-embrace the Weight Watchers of all, for all. That's all of our time today. We'll have to finish the interview with Seema Sistani, the article, The Witchy Ambition of Seema Sistani by Lauren Good on our next installment. You can listen to this program on demand at www.virginiavoice.org. I'm Valerie Haskins Moore for the Virginia Voice, and thank you so much for listening to What the Tech.